Blog Talk Radio.
It's Wednesday afternoon, and we're excited to be on the air. Your hosts for today's show are Robert Brining and Jack McEnroe. They will be taking your calls and speaking out on the topic of the week. You're encouraged to call in and share some of your life experiences. The number to call is 347-215-9442. That's 347-215-9442. Welcome to PosIM Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Wednesday. Welcome to PosIM Radio. I am your host, Robert Brining. I am waiting for my co-host, Jack McEnroe, to call in, so he may be a couple minutes late. I just want to go ahead and thank you all for tuning in. If you're tuning in for the first time, we do air twice a week, Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Today I have a special guest, but before I tell you about my guest today, I'm going to let you know about the next two shows that are coming up. Next Wednesday, we will this Sunday, actually, we will have Michael Mancia, who is the author of a book called Love in the Time of HIV, The Gay Man's Guide to Sex, Dating, and Relationships. So that may be a good one to call in and ask some questions. And I will also be having next Sunday, Jesse Sanchez will be joining me and Jack, who is actually a personal friend, I believe, of Jack's. Jack, is that right?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I got you.
Okay, good. And just so you know, I'm in Fort Lauderdale, so I keep dropping my call. So if I do disappear, I will call right back.
Okay, that's fine. But yeah, Jesse's going to come and share his story with us next Sunday, so I'm kind of excited about that.
Yeah, he's great. He's really funny. You'll you'll like him.
Yeah, we talked for a little bit on the phone when I set up a date with him, and he was quite a character.
Yeah, he's crazy. He actually does TV. That he'll tell his whole story, but he does TV down in or here where I am in Miami and the Fort Lauderdale area, and he's got a lot going on. He's really cool. Can I actually mention a couple of events before we get started?
Absolutely.
So the 7th of May, I'll be in Chicago for the ASC, which is the AIDS Foundation of Chicago's annual fashion event. It's called Make a Statement, Design for the Cure. And I'm going down there with my program, Living Positive by Design, which is my HIV/AIDS education initiative. It's a partnership with Merck. And it begins at 7 Eastern time, I guess. Well, Chicago time would be central. So once 7 o'clock or 7 p.m., and it's at the River East Art Center. And you can buy tickets if you go to www.aidschicago.org. That's a fashion show, and it's going to be a fun event. So that should be cool. And then on the 17th of May is AIDS Walk New York, which I just think everyone in New York, if you're in the New York area, should get involved in. And you can find out more information about that by, I believe it's just AIDSWalk.net, and then you click on New York, and they have all the information on that. And then my friend who is on, one more thing, who is on the benefit committee for, I think it's Cielo, it's C-I-E-L-O, Latino, which is the fundraising for the Latino Commission on AIDS, is having a big event at Cipriani's on the 12th of May. And Miss Universe is going to be the host, and Wilmer Valderrama, the Masters of Ceremonies, and you can buy tickets for that by going to www.latinoaids.org, and then you have to muddle your way around the website. But so that's what I got going on.
Not too much, right?
Yeah, not too much. And then doing this in between on the road, so
or the good thing is you only need a phone, right?
You only need a phone. Yeah,
so,
you only need a phone.
I just want to touch base a little bit on our guest today, who is Mark S. King, and he has been active in as an AIDS activist, a writer, and a community organization leader since the early 1980s in L.A. He has been an outspoken advocate for prevention education and for the issues important for those living with HIV. He was diagnosed in 85, and he held positions at the Los Angeles Shanti Foundation, AIDS Atlanta, and AIDS Survival Project, and is an award-winning writer. Several of his written pieces are available on thebody.com. He's also an author of the one and only book called A Place Like This, which is a memoir of his own life, and it talks about, you know, him becoming positive and recovering addict and things of that nature. And one of the big things people keep asking me about to talk to him about is when he was on The Price is Right.
I saw that little video clip. I actually just ordered his book this week. I haven't read it, but it looks interesting.
Yeah, the good thing I like about books like that is that they're real stories of somebody going through issues that I've went through. So I think that's actually a book that I can read.
Yeah. Yeah, have lots of pictures. It'll be good for you.
Well, I just like the fact that it's a personal story. You know what I mean? Like when I read these other ones that are put out by, you know, companies or whoever who write books all about it, people living with HIV and AIDS, it just doesn't seem real to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like I couldn't read a book on AIDS at all, and, you know, until I had Marvel and Brown, The Naked Truth. I read that and I was like, that's real to me. You know, it's a real story I could relate. So that was always
no, and I think it's great too that we have, and you have in the past on this show had a range of people and you know, in the HIV AIDS community that have had different experiences, and he's obviously come back from a real struggle, you know, from the 80s when AIDS was a lot different than it is now. And then, you know, last week we had Angina, who is coming from a different perspective, and you and I are coming from different perspectives, and we all have our own personal experience. So I think that's what makes the show so interesting.
Yeah, well, I have Mark here on the line. So, Mark, welcome to Pause I Am Radio.
Thanks. Good afternoon. How y'all doing?
We're doing good. Where's, is that the southern accent? Is that Atlanta, y'all?
Oh, I just put it on where I think it'll get me somewhere. it's not all that natural.
Right.
But I am from Atlanta, so I can use that to my advantage here and there.
Excellent. I lived there for a year behind the Kroger on Ponce.
Oh, my. That's quite an infamous little neighborhood.
It was. Everybody always says that. It was funny. But I liked Atlanta. It's wicked hot in the summer, but good times.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it a lot.
So, Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit of your background of when you became infected and things of that nature.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm 48, and I've been positive forever, since the beginning. I think the test was became available in 1985. I took it when it came out and was positive. So,
wow.
Yeah, so it was then. Now, I could probably trace my infection back to a few years earlier than that. You know, I moved to L.A. when I was 20 in 1981 and kind of had my summer of love in L.A. So it's very likely that I was, you know, had been infected for a few years.
Wow.
And, yeah, and so I was an actor in L.A. and was just living my, you know, little shallow life of going to the bars and doing commercials and television and all that. And then, you know, it was the 80s. AIDS came along, you know. And I think by the time it was 1986 or 87, I stopped everything else that I was doing and went to work for an AIDS agency. That was the Shanti Foundation, the oldest agency in Los Angeles. And it was just, you know, a small little group, you know, maybe five or six employees. And what an exciting, I mean, you know, you take away just the horrific factor of living life during those years, and what a fascinating time to be working on a public health issue. You know, it was dramatic, it was terrifying, and but it was also incredibly exciting just because everything was changing so fast, you know.
Right.
I got to work at Shanti and become the director of public relations during a time where in Hollywood people would do anything for us. You would just pick up the phone and call anybody, all the fundraisers, stars, whatever was needed, they were right there for us. And then eventually moved to Atlanta and became director of an AIDS agency. And along the way, yeah, there was a big cocaine problem in the 80s during the time that I was an actor. It's something that I kind of cleaned up when I started working for the AIDS agency and kind of put it aside, got on with my AIDS career, came to Atlanta, was director of an AIDS agency, and then got completely hooked up into crystal meth and was eventually became a daily shooting up drug addict. Just a horrible period of 5 or 10 years for me where all of that stuff I had built up, you know, the a strong reputation in the community, director of an AIDS agency, all of that stuff, and I was reduced to just this junkie and doing everything I had, counseled others not to, for all of those years. And so it's been really kind of this digging myself out of that hole for the last 6 years to come back to a place where I feel good about myself again, where I'm involved with the community again. I can kind of hold my head up a little bit higher than I had. But a real cautionary tale, I'm afraid.
Right. I mean, addiction, it goes along with a lot of destructive and unfortunate behavior, but it's like HIV, it's a disease. So, you know, I mean, there's obviously shame that's built into that, but, you know, you recognize that you needed help. And how long have you been sober at this point?
I have been in a program of recovery for about 6 years, but I have relapsed back and forth and back and forth. And today I can count my clean time in months rather than years.
Right.
Now, did you use like a 12 step?
I have been involved with that. Okay. I try to be careful so that I'm not promoting anything one way or another. There's so many ways that people put their lives back together again. You know, they could be going to 12-step meetings like Crystal Meth Anonymous, or they could reach out to their community of faith or go with therapy, or all, you know, there's all sorts of avenues for people to kind of get to the same destination. And I have used a combination of all of those things.
Right. Which I think go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just think that I think it's important to say that because I've never been in a 12-step program or anything like that, but a lot of them profess to be like the answer and the only way, and I watch Intervention and they're like, if you don't get into the 12-step program, it's not going to work. But I do think, you know, there are other ways to go about it. I'm not obviously not an expert in addiction, but you probably know much more about it than I do. But I think that's a good point to make. There's therapy, there's personal therapy, there's different support groups. It doesn't necessarily have to be a 12-step program.
Yeah, well, and that's absolutely right. You know, the point is for me though is you got to pick something and stick with it. You know, because a lot of people are like, well, I went to therapy, it didn't work, I started using again. Well, you know, how committed were you to the therapy? Or, well, I went to a 12-step meeting and I went to those for a while and it didn't work. Well, how committed were you to that? You know, you got to decide which of those avenues you're going to take, and it really comes down to, are you ready? You know, are you ready to give up all of this? And you know, the residue of that way of existing is still on me. I mean, it's still something that I'm flushing out. And I don't just mean the drugs out of my system. I mean just the way that I trained myself to think for all those years, you know, that I was, people's value was based on either sex or how much drugs they had, you know, and you know, I've been positive for so long that I didn't have to go through the agony of getting tested regularly and finding out if whether or not my bad behavior was going to come back to haunt me, you know.
Right.
I have so much respect for anybody who is HIV negative today and is you know, sexually active. They deserve a medal. There should be parades for those guys because they, unlike me, who just had to take the test once 25 years ago, they get tested, what, every 3 months, every 6 months? And literally, their behavior is tested. Have you been a good boy? Have you been playing by the rules? Let's find out. Let's take a test every 3 months, you know. And just the stress of having to go through that, I don't know that we when I say we, I worked in its education for so long, and I've always questioned whether or not we lifted up HIV negative men in the way that we support HIV positive men. I could behave any way I wanted to,
right,
not have to suffer the consequence of a positive test result. I got my test result 25 years ago, never had to take it again.
Right.
You know, as opposed to a negative guy who is out there making choices every day, negotiating safe sex, trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely unique challenges facing someone who's HIV positive and someone who's maintaining an HIV negative status. I mean, they both come with their unique challenges in different respects. So, yeah, kudos to everyone who's having protected sex and doing everything they're supposed to. But at the same time, it's not meant to bash anyone. Like, we're not bashing people that unfortunately are HIV positive. So,
right.
I just want to ask you personally. Obviously your addiction had taken over at this point, but weren't you concerned about the negative effects of Crystal and on your health, knowing that you already had? I mean, I don't know. We maybe could delve into how was your health during that whole time.
Well, my health has always, despite all the odds, my health has always been good. It's been fairly, I have not had a problem with opportunistic infections or anything like that. But the question you ask is, wasn't I concerned about the health? My health would be a reasonable question to ask a sane person.
Right.
You know, why wasn't I concerned about what my family would think? Why wouldn't I be concerned about what people at the sex club would think who were witnessing me engaging in unsafe behavior publicly while director of an AIDS agency? You know, there's lots of good questions that a sane person would go, oh, well, that would just be crazy. I wouldn't want to do that. But you know, the point is I wasn't sane. I was a drug addict in the throes of addiction who was just doing anything I could to continue using, continue lying about it, and getting what I wanted, which was more.
Right.
I sacrificed my health. I sacrificed my reputation, family, relationships, all of those things. And speaking of my health, you know, there are other things to catch that make a direct impact on my health in addition to the HIV, like other sexually transmitted diseases or hepatitis C, which I did contract. I got hep C from sharing needles, dirty needles, like me, an AIDS educator. I got hep C. I had to go through a year of chemotherapy to rid my body of it, and that was hell. That was frankly worse than anything I've ever had experience with my HIV, and that was a direct result of my using. And I kept going on. I kept using after that. So, you know, those are good questions. Unfortunately, I wasn't a sane enough person to process that question and do anything about it.
Well, I can totally understand what you're saying, because, Mark, I told you before, like, when I read some of your story and listened to your blog, a lot of it I can relate to. And that's really why I wanted you to share your story with us, is because it is so relatable. I mean, you know what I mean? I've went through the addiction to meth and to cocaine and things like that. So and going to the sex clubs and experiencing, you know, trying to find my self-worth there when it was with me all along. And that's why I asked about the 12-step program, because I went to NA and I went and you know, did the whole 90 meetings in 90 days and the whole thing that they tell you to do, and I went straight for a year. But I think since I was I went and got clean, let's say, in December of 2000. In January of 2001, my father passed away, and then in June of 2001 is when I was diagnosed. And I think that going to those programs and learning how to share and really learning how to love myself kind of helped me accept my status a little bit better. Do you feel that helped you? I mean, well, yours was later on, so I guess would be a little not
well,
a question,
but No, but because your point is still a good one, and that is that it doesn't matter where we are on our life path. You know, the fact is that, you know, if we've been engaged in self-destructive behavior of whatever it is, you know, programs like that do help us go, wait a second, is this what I really want to be doing? You know, and what does this say about how I feel about myself that I would treat myself so badly, you know, and that's a helpful inner dialogue for anybody to have. And some people go through, you know, like you say, Narcotics Anonymous. Some people go through that, they stick with it for a while, and they get a lot out of it. They take what they need and they move on. Maybe mm-hmm. they stop going to that. That's fine, you know. I whatever works, you know. This whole journey for me has been so beyond just the drugs and alcohol. You know, it made me realize that, you know, my entire life has been hiding out. You know, I you wouldn't think so on the surface of it. I was very out about being HIV positive as soon as I was tested, you know. And then in 86 or 87, I was giving interviews and encouraging other people about HIV and that it wasn't a death sentence, even when it kind of was. but that kind of public persona belied a complete lack of self-esteem, a complete self-loathing that I had, because I was acting out in all sorts of ways. I was never faithful to a partner. Compulsive sex was always the part of my life, and I thought that my self-worth was all wrapped up in that. You know, what I looked like, how often I worked out, how many tank tops I could possibly hold in my closet. You know, and...
Well, I think that's your story. That's why it's not uncommon. I think they're, you know, especially, I think drugs and, you know, self-loathing and shame of the gay, that's why drugs are so prevalent in the gay community, and, well, I mean, they're prevalent in a lot of communities, but I just think that gay people, and then HIV-positive people on top of that are, you know, told either very directly or kind of subliminally from when we're kids that we're not worth loving, or we're not lovable, yeah. or not right, or we're not socially yeah. acceptable, and I think that, you know, feeds directly into the, well, what's going to make me happy? What's going to fill the void that I didn't get when I was growing up? So
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
A lot of people can relate to your story.
And I distinctly remember in high school, you know, the whole best little boy in the world sort of syndrome, class president, straight-A student, you know, all of those things. And I know it was a conscious effort to be as good as I could be for the day that my parents found out I was gay. Because then I could say, but Mom, I've got straight A's. and as a matter of fact, that conversation eventually happened. And I said, Mom, I've got straight A's. And she said, it's not about your grades. You know, and that kind of took a wind out of my sails. I thought, rats, I've been working so hard. And turns out that's not impressing her. She's more concerned about the fact that she's got a gay kid.
Right.
So that the whole sense of hiding out and trying to be, whatever, and like I was saying, that residual stuff still stuck with me. I was just having a conversation with somebody about, you know, if I have a friend that's exceptionally good looking, it's hard for me to be happy for him, because I'm like, damn, I used to be that. I used to be young. I used to be pretty. Oh, I love your pictures, Jack. By the way, I love your pictures, and I've downloaded some. I want to make a screensaver out of this one picture of you, but I have, because my screen is so wide, I can't. I have to decide between your face and your chest as to what's going to be on my screen. Guess what won?
And moving on.
Tell us a little bit about your vlog, because I know you have a vlog on the body, and I've watched a few of your. Oh, your videos, and they're hilarious, Mark. Hilarious.
Okay.
But to the point.
Well, you know, and that's kind of how I communicate, is I know that I can come off as flip sometimes, but it's levity for me. It's just a way of trying to speak the truth. But I do see things as kind of funny, kind of humorous, and the blog is thebody.com has been so great to me and has basically allowed me to do anything I want and to speak about anything I want. I mean, there's video blogs on there about sex and dating and behavior, and I take the camera with me to my doctor appointments and to dinners with friends where we all just kind of speak the truth about what's going on in our lives. And I even took it to I even did a blog on, you know, I've had facial wasting as a result of being on HIV drugs for so long. And of course, you know, as we've established, I'm vain and self-absorbed. And it was a lot easier being a role model for HIV when I didn't look like I had it. But when you start to look like you have it, for me, it's made me really self-conscious. And it was upsetting to me. And I had to figure out, and so I decided to go get, you know, the facial fillers where they kind of, they restore the fat in your cheekbones so that you don't look like you have that wasted look from HIV drugs. And so I filmed that. I interview the doctor, and they show him doing the injections, and I ask him questions about it. And a lot of my questions were along the lines of, why am I doing this? You know, what am I covering up here? You know, is this once again Mark playing the vanity card and trying to not look 48 years old anymore, because you do kind of get a more youthful appearance as a result? Or am I trying to cover up the drug addiction? Because how much of this wasting might be as a result of crystal meth addiction for 10 years? And obviously, you know, of course, I eventually did it, and the doctor kind of assured me that these were, you know, based on my drug history, that these were certainly side effects of that. But in all of them, I keep a light attitude, because that's just the way I communicate, and they're a lot of fun to do, and I get emails from around the world. It's so humbling. There will be emails. I got an email the other day from some guy that said, he was responding to one of the blogs, and he said, you know, thanks for doing this, you give me hope. And it was signed, some man from Uganda.
Right.
And it made me want to cry. I was like, I give this man hope. I mean, Uganda, for God's sake. It was just really humbling to realize that there's a lot of things we take for granted. You know, we have the great privilege to be sitting here on the phone, having some laughs and sharing good information. And there's so many people that don't have that privilege. They're afraid to talk about it. They don't have the information about prevention or anything. You know, they don't have the privilege of having friends to talk to. And that blog is an outlet for them, and so is your website, Robert. I mean, all of those avenues the internet has provided do a real service to people who don't have anybody else to talk to.
Right. Yeah, no, that, yeah, we should plug the body.com is a great website, and your own personal website is marksking.com, correct?
Right, that's right. Mark and Sam King.
So they can contact you through that. Yeah, but no, I feel the same way. You know, there's people from all over the world that one can listen to this show, and can the internet's just opened so many avenues for people who may live somewhere rural, may live somewhere in a, you know, foreign country that doesn't have access to the things that we take for granted. So
yeah,
it's great. Just mention all these sites and where people can go to find information on medication and just self-educate, because I think, you know, we need to advocate for our own health.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Nope. Mark, one of the vlogs you did, you mentioned Louise Hay.
Yes.
And I'm trying to put it together, but I'm thinking it's the same Louise Hay who wrote the book You Can Heal Your Life.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes.
Because, only one Louise Hay.
Well, I just wanted to make sure, because you never know. And it's just interesting because I just picked up that book about a month ago and I just started reading it. And, you know, since my partner is in the spiritual realm of work and his job, you know, I get attracted to a lot of those kinds of books like that. And I found it very interesting. I didn't know she was, you know, active in the AIDS community, you know, back in the day. Like she
well,
was.
She sure was, and she deserves a lot of credit for that. You know, she is kind of a controversial figure, and I'm not even sure ultimately what, how much I buy into a lot of what she's sharing. But I give her credit for this. She showed up at a time when nobody else wanted to be dealing with the likes of me. It was in the mid-1980s, and people were dropping. I lived in West Hollywood. People were dropping like flies. And, and I mean, really the terrific numbers. And she started holding these, they called them the Hayrides. It was the Hayrides, and it was Louise Hay hosting once a week at a park, in Plummer Park in West Hollywood. And it was a little kind of community center packed to the, I mean, packed wall-to-wall people, because she would just stand up there for an hour or so and share this message. And her message was essentially, love yourself. Love your disease. You're worthy of love. Love yourself. And, you know, you got to go back to the mid-80s where not only was gay pride still kind of a new concept, but we were also being, thrown out of our homes and disowned by our families, and people were finding out that they had AIDS and had to tell their family, I'm gay, I have AIDS, and then dying shortly thereafter.
Right.
I had friends whose last words with their parents were their parents telling them they were going to go to hell. And,
right.
and in that whole environment, you have this woman who has the guts to hold these free community forums so that it could be packed with all of these men living with AIDS. And I had never seen so many people with AIDS before. It wasn't a normal thing to be having public forums like that, you know, and I would just look around at these sea of people, and they had, you know, they had Kaposi's sarcoma, you know, they had marks all over their face, and they were in wheelchairs, and they were riveted by her every word. Because
for people that aren't really familiar with her, I'm sure you know much better than I do, but basically her whole sort of concept that she speaks about is that we're very in control of our disease and our health through our what we think and what we do. Correct? I mean, am I on the right track?
Yes. It's kind of like the power of positive thinking, and. She saw, and this is kind of where I don't quite buy into it, but I appreciate
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think that's where she gets a little controversial when she says you
yeah,
have a direct
she
link.
She says
like
love yourself, and that illness is a state of mind, and that if you love yourself, you can love yourself out of illness, and that sounds all well and good, except you had people dying regularly, and so the implication was, well, they didn't love themselves, and that's why they died. You
right.
know, I don't think so. But again, most of her message was, you know, was very easy to swallow, and she was truly a heroic figure to even be having these meetings. And
of course, and I don't think you can't deny the power of positive thinking in terms of dealing with illness and dealing with health and. You know, I don't know if it gets as literal as you can, you know, create or get, you know, get rid of a serious illness by the way you think. But I do think the gist of her message is useful.
Yes, absolutely. And she was giving us permission to love ourselves. Again, in an environment in which we weren't feeling too much love for ourselves. We felt nothing but horror. And shame and fear, and it took a lot of courage for her to
right.
say, you know, you can reject that. You are worthy of love. And, you know, that was the message we needed to hear at that time. And
we still need to hear it. we still have a long way to go. Actually, I was in a chat room earlier this week, and what the topic was, you know, shame and HIV, and someone, which I've heard before, is like, well, you know, if you have cancer and you're coping with it, you're a survivor, and you're like a hero, and if you're battling various other ailments and you're doing well, it's like, oh, what a strong fighter you are. But if you're HIV positive, it's like, you know, people won't talk about it, like it's shameful, you should be embarrassed. It's like, it's so bizarre, this double standard, that this disease carries this huge stigma, and it shouldn't be that way. So we just need to keep being visible and being out about it, and, you know, not necessarily proud is not the right word, but, you know, own it, and it is what it is, and there shouldn't be a moral judgment on it.
Yeah. And, absolutely. He's well said.
One of the other things that you have done, Mark, I went and saw your other video montage of all your commercials that you've done back in the day, and I have to tell you, they were kind of funny. Because you know, it wasn't funny because it was, you know, you were in it. It was funny for me because they were old time commercials. They were commercials that I don't even remember seeing.
How old are you?
I'm 20. I'll be 30 in May.
Oi.
I know, right?
Well, yeah, right.
I'll be 40 in exactly a week.
Yeah.
Well, happy birthday to you both. I hate
Thank you.
You know.
None of that tells.
Yeah, the commercials are all from late 70s, early 80s, and as you probably noticed, I specialized in playing complete dorks. You know, I was this skinny, gawky kid with carrot red hair, and so I remember I think it was the Popeye's Fried Chicken commercial,
mm-hmm.
going to that audition, and the director saying, "You're just perfect for this," and I'm feeling all happy and proud of myself. And he says, "Because you look just like an ostrich, and that's what we want here. We want a guy that looks like an ostrich. So keep sticking your neck out, really, and give us that dorky thing. You do that so well." I'm like, I'm so proud of myself.
Thanks, dude.
How proud I feel, you know. But you'll see commercial after commercial, I just play nerds and dorks. And it's funny because, although, you know, it was a good living, I lived in West Hollywood, California, where everybody was more beautiful than the next, you know, and I made my living looking like a dork. So, that had something to do with my sexual acting out, because I would, you know, spend the day filming some commercial being a dork, and then I would go dress all slutty and go to the Spike or something and pretend. I didn't succeed. I looked like Opie does leather going to places like that. But I did my best. And it was a certain acting out, because I thought, I don't want to look like this. You know?
I also think in those kind of in the entertainment industry, you're judged all the time on your appearance. And it's like, if you're not a secure person to begin with, it's like, to have people just critique you and say you look like an ostrich, it's like, I don't think it does anything for your psyche.
No, and in fact, my livelihood depended on it. You know, my agent would tell me, you know, keep your hair cut this certain way, and don't grow a mustache, or don't work out, stay skinny, and my livelihood depended on me maintaining that kind of look all the time, and I had to accept it. I had to accept that was my niche, and I might as well, you know, you're not going to turn, an orange into an apple. I was an orange, and that was that. You're an apple, Jack. I'm an orange.
One of the other things that actually Bob Adams from Paws Magazine emailed me this morning and said, please, please ask Mark about The Price is Right. So I have to ask you about being on The Price is Right.
Oh,
I love The Price is Right.
I love The Price is Right. Well, this was way back when, you know, Bob Barker was there and he had brown hair. So this may be before both of your times.
I remember when he had brown hair with that skinny little weird microphone.
Yes, that's right. And it was before I had moved to L.A., and my my lover Charlie and I had driven to California for a vacation. And we were going to take a tour of CBS Studios. And we got there, and they didn't give tours anymore. But they said, oh, there's a line over there to get on the Price is Right. You go stand on that line. So we're like, sure. So we go stand in line. We're wearing matching outfits, by the way. You know, we're wearing matching outfits from this gay disco in Houston. And we were in that early wearing matching
outfits. Do you remember what year this was?
Yes, this was 1980. I was 19 years old.
Oh, my God.
I was 19, and my hair was bright orange, and it was parted right down the middle and feathered like Farrah Fawcett, you know?
Oh, I had mad-ass feathered hair. Woo-hoo!
So we go, and what they do is they interview everybody standing in line to see who would make a good contestant. You know, they don't tell you they're going to pick you, but they talk to everybody and kind of make notes, you know? And so I jump up and down and squeal, you know, when they're talking to me, and mentioned that I had come all the way from, you know, Louisiana just to be in that show, is what I lied. And so anyway, you know, the show starts, and, you know, Mark King, come on down. And so I come on down, and I was the first person up on, I was one of the first four, and then I won the first thing up for bids. It was a radar range, and so I win that and get up on stage and out rolls this car. And I play that game where you have to guess the price of the car one digit at a time. And it gives you
$7 bills.
Yes.
Yeah. No one ever wins that game.
I did.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, my God, I love it.
Well, first of all, maybe it wasn't as hard back then because they give you $7 and the price of the car is only four digits.
Right, right, right.
$80. And
so their cars were like $8,000.
Yeah. Well, actually, even less. It was a Pontiac Phoenix LJ Coupe, a 1981. And you know, you see it on the tape, and it just looks like it's like that. I'm gonna win that. You know, it's just like ridiculous old-looking boxy car, but I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to play the game. I was in a complete dream world because I was so shocked that I was standing up there, and so I just, you know, laughed and smiled, and then I would look toward Charlie and the audience because whenever Bob Barker asked me to do something, I was completely clueless as to what was going on, and I would look at Charlie, and Charlie would say, say six, or say five, and so I guessed the numbers one by one, and I got the first numbers right. It was a six, and then a five, then I guessed another number, and it was almost right, and I ended up winning the car, and Bob Barker is talking to me while we're playing the game, and he says, this is an awfully nice car, Mark, you know. I told him I was from New Orleans, and he says, this is an awful nice car. Hey, you got a girlfriend back there in New Orleans? and I'm thinking, what should I do? I mean, in that split second, I thought, oh, I could come out on national television, you know, but it was 1980, and that might have been a bit premature. So
They would have edited it out anyway.
Yes, absolutely. They would have edited it out. So I said, oh, yes, several.
Right.
And I'm like, well,
several,
cool.
With
I
a
have,
big ass.
I got lots of girlfriends, you know? Yeah. So I win the car, and I kid Charlie. They showed Charlie more than they showed me. And it was so clear. You can go on my website. The tape is on my
website. You can watch it on there.
Because he is whistling and jumping up and down and doing all this stuff, and they showed him more than me, and he's like jumping out of his chair. I told him if I had won a fur coat, he would have jumped on stage and put it on. he was so proud, so happy.
That's great.
It was just unbelievable.
I might just let people know if they're out there listening, you can call in and ask us a question or Mark. at 347-215-9442. And that question about the Price is Right was actually from Bob Ickles. I said Bob Adams earlier, so I gave the wrong name out.
And then, just again to say it again, his website is markfking.com,
right,
where you can see him win his $6,000 car. So wait, I want to talk. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Mark where people can get his book real quick.
Yeah, that's what I was actually going to lead into.
Oh, sure. You can. Easiest thing to do is get it on Amazon.
That's where I bought it. I bought it 3 days ago.
Oh, you did? Good.
Yeah.
I appreciate the thanks for the 63 cents because
right.
I appreciate that. But it's on Amazon. It's on all those sites online that you can buy it. And there's a link to Amazon from my website. Or you can just go to Amazon. The name of the book is A Place Like This. A Place Like This. And it is about my time in Los Angeles in the 80s. It actually begins talking about The Price is Right because I kind of use that as a metaphor for Hollywood and for all the things that were to come. There's kind of foreshadowing in there about AIDS and everything else. And then what, you know, a lot of the book deals with, you know, just the Hollywood nerdy actor thing, becoming, I actually, before I went to work in AIDS, I wasn't making quite enough money being an actor, so I opened a phone sex company, which were very big at the time.
Yeah, I read that.
So I would train all these people to talk passionately on the phone so that we could get a lot of customers. And it was a very funny business. also very interesting into the kind of inner workings of the male sexual psyche. And it was just very interesting business. And I sold that when I went to work for AIDS. So I left kind of a commercial sex business to go to work for an AIDS agency.
Do you talk about the sex fun line in the book?
Oh, yeah.
There's good stories in there.
Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time with that because it's easy to make fun of, and there's a lot of funny aspects of what that business was like because, first of all, I mean, this was in the olden days before there were computer phone lines and all of that. This was, you'd use a credit card, it cost $45, and you would get to order what kind of man you would like to call you back. Oh, we got all sorts of guys. You want them hairy, you want them smooth, you want a fireman, you want whatever. And then lo and behold, somebody would call you who happened to meet your description.
Be that exact thing.
That's exactly what you wanted. Because we were getting calls from guys in Iowa and Ohio, and they figured, well, I'm calling Los Angeles. I bet they have thousands of guys in their stable to talk to. When in fact it was, you know, I had 10 employees and they were actors and they could be a surfer dude one minute and a, you know, leather man the next. And it was funny because anthropologically it was fascinating in terms of getting that insight in terms of what made those men tick. But it was also, I didn't mind leaving it because I did thousands of the calls myself, and I mean thousands, and I had customers that I talked to once or twice a week, and this was never any sort of, there was never any erotic agenda on my part. It was a matter of kind of zeroing in on what made them tick and giving it to them, and it was innocent fun. But the fact is that they would share things about their, you know, I would talk to them regularly, once or twice a week for years. I saw them through boyfriends and relationships and coming out to their family and all sorts of stuff, you know. And what was bothered me about it is they knew nothing about me. They thought they did. I had answers for any question. I could tell them all sorts of details about working out on Venice Beach between my stints and a minor league baseball player, or you know, the volunteer fire department, or some other, you know, gay cliche. But I was very convincing. They thought they knew who I was, and they would confide in me. And it was strange. I was such a lie.
That's what I was gonna say. I'm like, isn't there a part of you that then starts to feel guilty about that? Like, that you're just not, that you're lying.
I'm a liar. Well, and the fact is that attribute of being a good liar was something that had served me so well all my life. I was an actor, which was essentially, you know, playing a part. Then I did this company where I was playing a different role every 10 minutes. And then, you know, during my stint with AIDS, I became a drug addict where lying is essential. So, you know, you could see a real pattern in my life of me not only just being a good liar, but what is it you want me to be? And I'll be that, you know, being an actor, you're so eager to please and take on whatever persona they're looking for. Same thing with the phone service. And then same thing through my drug addiction, trying to wear this mask of innocence when in fact I was a dangerously addicted individual, you know, and would use partners without regard to whether or not somebody might get hurt. You know, I went through a lot of relationships where I was just jumping from lily pad to lily pad. And I don't say, obviously, I don't say this with any sense of pride. This is stuff I'm still trying to forgive myself for and change. And that is that I never cared whether or not he might get hurt in the end. You know, I just cared about self-preservation. Yeah. And I could blame it on gay culture. I could say I was just a victim of gay culture mentality, but that's a real cop-out. At some point, we do have to grow up. We do have to take responsibility for our actions and make our own decisions about what kind of man we want to be. And I'm not the kid in the McDonald's commercial anymore. You know, I'm a guy with a serious addiction in his past that is just trying to carve out a life of integrity now. And that's a struggle every day because it's so easy for me to fall back. I want to fall back on old behaviors. You know,
right.
Oh, I know if I went and put that tank top on and slicked my hair back, I could strut around and look pretty good. You know,
okay.
I could, where does that get me? What exactly, in what circle would that be an attractive thing to do in terms of, I don't know. I hope you understand what I'm saying. Okay. I'm trying to grow up a little bit. And I'm still, as you can probably tell, I'm still in the process of sorting that all out.
Well, I think it's never ending. It doesn't matter how old you are. You're always seeking to improve yourself. And, you know, I mean, no one's perfect. There's always a course to a final, you know, to a destination or an aspiration that you hope to be or become. And, you know, we all have our own struggles and we all deal with them the way we deal with them.
Yeah. And writing that book was a big part of it for me because it is a search for meaning, for lack of a better word. I don't want to make too, you know, grand a point of it, but we're all just trying to get through all of this and do the best we can. And in the course of time the book covers, I'm going through the 80s. There's drugs, there's sex and Hollywood and all of those things going on. And then this huge thing called AIDS happens and asks all of us, you know, are you going to step up to the plate? Are you going to kind of put aside, you know, more trivial pursuits, as it were, and step up and do something good, contribute, help somebody else? It was a real test of our character as a community as to whether or not we were ready to do that. And I'm proud of the fact that I did step up and I did do the right thing. And then after many years of doing that, you know, my baser instincts took over. I was swept back into drug addiction. And now it's time to to lift myself up and get back in the game and contribute again.
One of the things for me I noticed is that when I was, you know, using the drugs and stuff like that, I was always looking for acceptance or trying to find who I was, you know, to finally be happy with me. And I know that now doing the work with the website and now the radio show, I get so much healing from the feedback. Do you find that you get a lot of self-healing from all the feedback from all the people on your vlog?
I do. I do. And you know what, though? It's hard for me to hear it. I need to really hear it because I tended to discount the value of that. Somebody would say, thank you so much for that blog. That really helped me understand that issue, or I feel differently about it. I'm like, oh, that's nice, you know. You know, what, nobody's making a comment about how great my hair looked that day. Or, you know, again, I hate to sound so repetitive, but I was really swept up in the whole lipsism sort of thing. And by the way, this is not meant to put down people who do look great in tank tops and do take care of themselves and look fantastic, because, you know, more power to them. And they probably do it for, they're probably motivated by healthier things than I am. In other words, they're doing that because it is about health, and they do want to look good, and et cetera, et cetera. Me, I go to the gym and I work out with weights. I don't do any cardio. I never have, because it's not about cardiovascular health. It's about, you know, my shirt being tight around the arms.
Right.
You know, and it's...
Well, there's a lot of that going on in the gay male community, so you're not alone in that respect, of course.
Well, you know, and of course there is, but my job is to rise above it, because whereas other people can observe that in our community and go, well, that's kind of silly, for me it was absolutely dangerous. It was life and death, because I bought into it so much that's what I was all about. And so,
right.
Again, it's a dangerous place for me to be. I'm not saying it's dangerous for other people, you know.
Well, like, I think like anything, there's a healthy way to go about things, and then there's the extreme, and that's motivated from a non-healthy place. So, you know, that can be true of many situations.
Mark, we're down to the last 2 minutes. Real quick, something I started this Sunday show is I want to start asking every guest, what has your HIV status taught you?
What has it brought me?
Taught
you.
Taught. Life is short. Life is short, and live in this moment right now. And when you think about, when you're worrying about what happened yesterday, when you're thinking back too far, or you're worried about what's going to happen in the future, you're not living in the present, obviously. You know, somebody once told me this, and that is, I got to remember where my feet are. I got to look down and go, okay, I'm right here. It's a beautiful day in Atlanta. I'm talking to two great guys on the radio, and life is good.
Thank you, Mark, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And for more
information, great chatting with you.
You guys
Thanks.
Can go to his website at www.marksking.com. I'll throw that up into the chat room. Mark, thanks for joining us, and have a great afternoon, man.
Thanks, you too.
Rock on, and good luck with everything.
And remember, you can learn more about Jack at jackmackenroth.com. We'll put that in the website, too. And his livingpositivebydesign.com, you can check that out, too. And you can learn more about the PosIM community at posim.com. Next week, Jack, we have Jesse Sanchez. I'm kind of really excited to have him on.
Yeah, on my birthday.
Yeah, on your birthday.
Bitch better give me a good present.
I know, he's something special.
Yeah, please, no singing, please.
I won't sing, trust me.
Oh, yeah, and nobody wants to hear me sing. No. I do not have a singing voice for radio, trust me.
And just a reminder that people can follow me and Jack both on Twitter, and we also have a PosIM Radio fan page on PosIM.com and on Facebook. Other than that, Jack, enjoy the rest of your time in Florida.
I will. Actually, I'll still be here, I think, on Wednesday when I call next time. So I'm just down here swimming my butt off. So I will talk to you in a week.
All right. You have a good week, man.
You too. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Bye.